talking here in chapters 2 and 3 of book 2 in C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And by the way, these are on the website. They have been archived under studies for Mere Christianity, the things we've done so far. Last time we were talking about the invasion, chapter 2, and about how we live in enemy-occupied territory, as Lewis calls it. We talked some about how Lewis relates the problem of atheism, that it was too simple, because somewhere along the line, this idea of what is good and what is bad, what is evil, what is not, had to have been given somewhere to us, and atheism is just way too simple in trying to look at the world and at all of this, and real things, reality itself, is not simple. We agreed on that last week. I asked the question, and everyone either nodded or yes, it's not simple. But we also talked about how if we take a childish approach to religion, that doesn't help us either. A child's version, because we don't end up thinking about the problems and the other things. We talked about how Christianity, as Lewis puts it, Christianity is not a religion that anyone would have invented or thought of, any human. God coming in the flesh to settle our debt by himself giving and dying so that we would not have to pay that debt. I mean, who in their right mind would ever come up with such a thing? Only God. Only God. And as we ended last time, we were getting ready to talk about the problem and two views and then move toward chapter 3. The problem is, he said, the universe is full of things that are obviously bad. The universe contains creatures who know that things are bad. So how do we reconcile that without God and without God doing this? And he talks about dualism. And I believe this is where we ended. I said when he mentioned dualism, dualism basically takes the approach that everything's good or bad, right or wrong, black or white. There are not shades of gray. Dualism also looks at, classifies things within a dualistic perspective, especially within Gnosticism and other things. Flesh is bad, not because of how it's used, but simply because it's temporary. Spirit is good, simply because it is eternal. And so within that sense of dualism, then you have other terms, light and darkness, love and hate, and there are no places in between. But when we look at that and we think about the devil, we who are Christians talk about the devil, and the devil, most of us think and would say the devil enjoys being devilish, right? The devil enjoys being devilish. The devil enjoys being bad. But if that is the case and the devil enjoys it and the devil is a power that likes badness simply because it's being bad, and I don't mean bad like you walk down the street with a chip on your shoulder, but being evil, why? I mean, who in the world would want to be that way? The bad power then must be like a god. And the world itself is a battlefield. But we have a good power and a bad power, and yet neither one of them can be God, right? Because by definition, God, by our definition, God is what? God is one. God is over the universe. God has all power and authority. So while each thinks of itself as a god, neither one could really be God. One likes hate and cruelty simply for the sake of being hateful and cruel. One likes love and good for the sake of being good. And yet, what is goodness? What does Lewis say about goodness? Goodness is what? It is itself. What is badness? Well, something we don't like, the opposite, but how does it get that way? If God creates the world and the world is good, and in Genesis chapter 1, God creates humanity at the end and says it's very good, then what is badness? Spoil goodness. That's right. Spoil goodness. Francis Redd, yes. It is spoiled goodness. So something has to be good before it can be spoiled. The milk has to be good before it can go bad, right? And most of the time, it doesn't go bad for at least 5, maybe 7 days after the date on the milk carton. Oh, yeah, you keep it in the refrigerator, keep it cold. Yeah. No, actually, the Wally World milk, I drink that way, too, and it does okay for about 5 days afterwards. Now, he says, if we speak of either as good or bad, then we must mean that the one is right and one is wrong in thinking itself right. Okay? If both the good power and the bad power think they are good or they are right, then one of them's got to be wrong, right? Well, I mean, they're opposites, so one has to be wrong and one has to be right. They both think they're right, but neither, if one's bad and one is good, neither can, they can't both be correct. Right? So, one must actually be correct and one must actually be incorrect. Well, Lewis says there has to be a law or a standard then by which we determine whether one is correct, which one's correct and which one's not. And that law or that standard of good to which one power conforms and the other one does not cannot be created by those two powers. Why? Because they're on opposite sides. They wouldn't agree what was good. Therefore, it means there must be something or someone higher up and behind it that gives the law or the standard by which they determine whether their badness is right or their goodness is right. So neither of those powers, good or bad, including the devil, would be God. It is that power above them that gives the standard by which we judge and by which they are judged, good or bad. Therefore, that has to be the real God. And the one who is good is in right relationship with God, and the one who is bad is in a wrong relationship with God. He goes on to say that badness then by some could be seen as, or wickedness as pursuing good things the wrong way, using the wrong methods, or using something good in the wrong way to excess. And the Bible speaks of that. In Psalm 1, we have the writer talking about the good Jew as opposed to the wicked Jew. In Psalm 1, we won't go into a lot of detail about this because I want to stay with Lewis. But blessed are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. But their delight is in the law of the Lord, and on His law they meditate day and night. They are like trees transplanted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in its season, and their leaves do not wither. In all that they do, they prosper. The wicked are not so. They are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Wickedness, perish. And in Hebrew, that word to perish means will fade away to nothing. Will become nothing. But the way of the righteous will grow. And I read, my translation doesn't say that the righteous is like a tree transplanted. It says planted by, but the Hebrew word actually means to be planted by someone other than yourself. That's transplanted. We are not good. We are not righteous in and of ourselves. We are righteous and good when we are, because we are planted by someone else, by streams of water. And who is that someone else? God. It's God who transplants us and who overcomes our wickedness. But wickedness is pursuit of good in the wrong way. Even to be bad, we must take that which is good and pervert it. If God created everything good, then bad is good that has been perverted. Lewis says, evil is parasitic. It's a parasite that lives off the original thing. You know, a parasite lives off the original thing and grows off the original thing. He says evil is a parasite that lives off of good done the wrong way. Or also lives off of good that is not done by people who know to do good, but they sit back and let it go. Christianity, we're in a war of the worlds. Not with Tom Cruise, or although the original War of the Worlds movie I thought was better. But we are in a war in the world. A world that is in rebellion. What is the purpose? The question sometimes is asked, what is the purpose of going to church if we live in an enemy-occupied territory? And that's what Lewis says. He says, enemy-occupied territory, that is what the world is. Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign of sabotage. When you go to church, you're really listening in to the secret wireless from our friends. That's why the enemy is so anxious to prevent us from going. He does it by playing on our conceit and laziness and intellectual snobbery. I'm reminded of the story that was told by Martin Luther. I've told it here before, but it's been a few years. The story was told by Martin Luther that the devil and all his minions gathered for a report. And they were all gathered together, and the devil called on the first one of his minions to stand up and give his report. And he said, I attacked a caravan of Christians as they were going through the desert. And I killed them all, and now their bones lie bleaching in the sun. He was all proud of himself, and the devil looked at him and said, so what? Their souls were still saved. Another one stood up and said, I attacked a ship heavily laden with Christians going across the ocean and brought a great storm against it, and it sank, and every one of them lies at the bottom of the ocean. The devil shook his head and said, so what? Their souls were still saved. A third one stood up and he said, I worked for 10 years to get this one Christian to fall asleep in church and forget what he was supposed to do. Yesterday, I succeeded. And Luther said, all hell broke loose in cheers and rejoicing because one Christian had been lulled into forgetting what they were supposed to do. We have the opportunity to do good or to do less than good and twist it into something and pervert it into something that is bad. I've got a book in my office. I had to read it during my doctoral program, and it's a good book. It's by Stanley Hauerwas, and it's called Resident Aliens. And it talks about how really we as Christians are resident aliens in this world. The world is different. The world takes a different approach than we do. But we are resident aliens. We are different, or we're supposed to be different from the rest of the world, and yet we reside in it. That doesn't mean we become part of the world as in doing what the world does, but we're part of the world as in living there. And as resident aliens, we're supposed to try and change the culture rather than being changed by the culture. Sometimes we, and I don't want to get into political and other kinds of things, discussions, but sometimes we get upset because we end up with so many aliens in our country. I don't mean to kind of with the, my favorite Martian. And we talk about, what do we say? The culture has changed. And it has. In a lot of places in our country, even in our own area, the culture has changed. The aliens came and they live and the culture changes. Well, as Christians, we are the aliens. We are the ones who have not only the opportunity, but the calling. And this is part of what Lewis is saying here. We are in that enemy-occupied territory. Part of our calling is to be involved in campaigns of sabotage against the devil, or campaigns of sabotage against evil. To change the culture. to change that which was good, gone bad, now back into something that is good. To change that culture. And the devil, or the bad power, whatever you want to call it, uses deceit and snobbery and laziness and other ways to keep us from doing what we have been called to do. And that's in part why bad things continue to happen. Excuse me, I had to take that big gulp. That's what happens when you talk, and then you put the piece of cake in there and try and swallow it in your mouth and your throat are dry. Your mouth and your throat soak up all the moisture in the cake. It doesn't want to go down. So how do you feel about that? How do you feel about Lewis saying that we are resident aliens? Well, Hauerwas says that, but we live in enemy-occupied territory, and it's up to us to be like those resident aliens to change the culture instead of being changed by the culture. It's a tall task. It's a great task. Not only great, as in, boy, it's huge, but it's also great because it's a great thing if we can make those changes. Not just a good thing, it's a great thing if we can make those changes. Which then brings him to ask, then what do we do? How does evil enter the world, and how do we make those changes? And that's really what much of the rest of the book is about, is how we do that. One of the chapters upcoming has to do with being penitent. We don't like to be that, do we? I mean, really. We don't like to spend that much time on our knees being penitent. Most of us don't anyway. But that's one of many ways that we can. So as he moves into chapter 3 of book 2, nobody's going to jump on what I asked a minute ago. We'll move ahead. He talks about how when we look at this, there's something of a shocking alternative to all of this. A shocking alternative. The invasion has come. What was good has been perverted. But we are part of the next wave, the invasion, to turn things around. To wreak havoc against the perverted good, to help God in restoring that which is good. Now, first sentence of chapter 3 in book 2. Christians believe an evil power has made himself for the present the prince of this world. Right? Well, some do. Some would say no. God has placed him there. Which then raises another question. Is this God's will that the world has become perverted or not? Is it God's desire or not? Which is the stuff of volumes and volumes of commentaries and writings by all kinds of folks, from John Calvin and Martin Luther and St. Augustine to all kinds of other folks even today. And we can't solve all of that in 15 minutes. Because the debate still rages. And I mean rages because sometimes people get in a rage at each other over all of this. Is it in accordance with God's will that good was perverted and the world has become something different? And if it is, some might think, well, then God's kind of strange. Because how can anything happen contrary to the will of God? If God has absolute power, how can anything happen contrary to the will of God?
Yeah.
Well, First Baptist Church. They hung up, so it must have been the other guy. Wasn't even Dean Smith that time. Do what? Most or a lot of us would go back to choice, as we talked about the other day. Yes, Francis. Choice. Free will. God created things with free will. And free will then means that things can go right or things can go wrong. Because if we are indeed given free will and freedom to choose, we are free to choose that which is good and in accordance with God's desire. And I like to use the word, as y'all know, I would much rather use the word God, the words God's desire as opposed to God's will, because when we tend to think of God's will, we generally think of something that is enforced or coerced or placed upon us, as opposed to what was God's desire and did that happen as God would have liked for it to have happened. If we have God's will and it's coerced and enforced, there can't be free will. Not ultimate free will. There might be free will in some decisions here and there, but not the ultimate questions. There are only a couple of ways that evil can have run rampant and twisted good, and those are either through total free will and free choice to choose to follow God and obey or not, or for God to have created things so that they would go bad. Okay? Melissa? Huh? Yeah, you don't think God wants... So instead of God's will as it God willed it to go bad, you would talk more about God's desire that it be one way, but God gave freedom to choose.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're created in His image. I mean, why would He create us to go total opposite of Him?
Okay. Why would God create us to go totally opposite of Him? That's Paige's question. We're created imago Dei, image of God. Which is a question that is still wrestled with by different folks in different denominations and different theological camps. Even within Baptist circles, you've got people on both sides of the issue. There are those who... there has been a resurgence of predestinarian approaches in Baptist life. Yes, there has been a time, and throughout there have been droppings of Calvinism and foreordination in Baptist life, but the first Baptists that we trace our heritage back to were actually Arminian. Free will, free choice. It's not until that's Smith and Helwys started that first Baptist church in the Netherlands, and Smith brought it back in 1612 into London, wrote tractates. King James got mad at him because he said that the king couldn't tell you how you worship, threw him in prison, let him die there. He was very much Arminian. They were the general Baptists. We've talked about them before, the general Baptists. The particular Baptists come around in the 1630s, and they have a very strong Calvinistic slant. Eventually, they come to outnumber the general Baptists. And there were some that would do absolutely no evangelism at all, because if it's God's will that you be the elect, you're going to come regardless of what we do, so we're just going to stay here. I've shared with you before in teaching a course in Baptist history and polity one time, a number of years ago at a college, I came across part of an extant early particular Baptist hymn, and the verse was, "We are the Lord's elected few, let all the rest be damned. There's room enough in hell for you, we won't have heaven crammed." That was their approach. You know, God's elected us, and only the elect are going to get there, and forget the rest of you. Now, when we get into these things about free will as opposed to predestination or foreordination, that's where the problem really can grow. Lewis says, the interesting thing is when you here on page 47 in this book, but the bottom of the first page of The Shocking Alternative, when you make a thing voluntary, then half the people don't do it. That's not what you willed, but your will has made it possible. Why? Because you gave them free will to choose. You made it voluntary to follow or not. Now, I know there are passages in the Bible that talk about those whom I foreknew, I also predetermined or predestined. Do what? Yes. And then you've got Genesis chapter 2, where God creates the man and then plants the garden and then says, oh, by the way, you can eat anything you want to here. Except, you see that tree right there? Don't eat it. If you eat off that fruit, you're going to die. Well, if God didn't intend to offer the ability to choose, A, why put the tree in there to begin with? And B, why call special attention to it? And C, why allow the man and the woman to talk about it later on? Because they did. Because when the serpent shows up in Genesis 3 and says to the woman, and by the way, the man was there at the same time. He was just sitting back waiting to see what she was going to do. He was. That's what the text says. He was sitting there watching to see what was going to happen, and when it turned out that she didn't get sick or die, then he said, oh, okay, hey. But the serpent says anything, and she said, her answer was, God said we can eat of anything except for this tree. In fact, we can't even touch it, or we'll die. They talked about that for a while. They'd wondered every time they walked by that place. They wondered, as I said this morning, they wondered what in the world God was holding out. What's God holding out on us here? Must be something extra special about that. Of course, the thing was, you can be like God and know good and evil. Or don't do it and you won't know good or evil. Now, so Lewis says free will makes evil possible. Because we have the ability then to choose between good and bad. By the way, Calvin's not the only one to talk about predestination. Martin Luther actually talked about predestination, but it was single predestination. God predestined some for certain types of duties, such as priests, etc., to carry on the gospel. But everyone had an opportunity to choose to follow God or not. So it was kind of a limited predestination. Calvin, on the other hand, talked about predestination and actually eventually talked about what was called double predestination, and then some of his followers even became hyper-Calvinists, too many points to count. The three-point Calvinists, five-point Calvinists, and hyper-Calvinists. And Calvin said, God chose to elect some to be saved and others to be damned, and there's nothing you can do about it, but we all deserve condemnation. And the fact that God saves some shows God is a loving and merciful God. Now, a spin on that was, well, God predestined those who would be the elect and saved from before the foundation of the world. He just didn't choose the others. There's really no difference. That's semantics. He predestined some to be saved before the foundation of the world, and he predestined all these others not to be and to go into their baser, to be given over to their baser instincts so that they wouldn't be saved. That's the same thing as, you know, you predestined them to be condemned and these to be saved. It's the same thing as, well, we predestined these to be saved and we just didn't care about the others. And Augustine, or Augustine, whichever way you want to pronounce his name, St. Augustine or St. Augustine, also talked about foreordination and predestination. The interesting thing that I find in the Bible as a whole, there are some passages that, I mean, there's some difficult passages on either side. But most places, and especially in the New Testament, most places where predestination or foreordination is mentioned, it's not who is saved, but it is the kind of kingdom in which they will live, the kind of works which they will do, the ways they will live their lives. That was what was predetermined by God ahead of time, not who would be saved, according to those passages. But if you are among my people, these are the kinds of things that will characterize your life. I bet I could start Ephesians 2, 8, 9, and 10. And most of you could finish 8 and 9. Some of you have paid attention over time, may could finish 10 because I keep coming back to it all the time and saying it's part of the whole thing. But for by grace, keep going, through faith, not by works, is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast, or anyone should boast. What's verse 10? For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which He foreordained that we should live in them. Good works which He foreordained or predestined that we should live in them. It wasn't who was saved, but it was the kind of works that would show that you had faith and that you had accepted that grace. That was what was predestined. And the king shall say to those on his right hand, come, enter the kingdom which was prepared for you before the foundation of the world, for I was hungry, etc., etc. And Calvin says that means it's just for those elect that have been chosen before the foundation of the world. But Arminius and others would argue, no. Inherit the kingdom which was prepared before the foundation of the world for those who do what? Feed the hungry, give water to the thirsty, clothe the naked, do this to the least of these, my brethren. And would argue we have a choice whether to do it or not, right? So, the shocking alternative to all of this stuff and an evil power and a good power is if God gives us free will, then God doesn't desire that we do what is wrong, but God's desire is we do what is right. But God's desire is also that we have freedom of choosing as God does. If we are created in the image of God, we have the same right and freedom to choose. That's God's desire as well. And God desires that we choose good. And God desires that we choose God. But God takes a chance on whether we're going to or not. Love. We've used this before in some venues. Love. Paige, you find out, you tell Carrie you love him, you show him you love him, you give him gifts, all this kind of stuff. He does the same thing for you, and then after 15 years, one day he comes home and says, well, you know, Paige, I know we've had this great relationship and all this kind of stuff, and I really want it to continue, but I have to tell you that if I didn't do all this stuff for you and tell you that I love you, somebody was going to kill you and kill me. So that's why I've done this. How would you feel? Other than wanting to rip his head off, how would you feel?
Well, I'd feel betrayed.
Yeah, you'd feel betrayed. You'd feel pretty lousy and feel like it was all a sham. Well, that's another way to look at it. But the only reason he did that was because he was forced to do it. Had no choice. He was forced. On the other hand, after 15 years, Carrie comes to you and he tells you all these, you know, how much he loves you. He shows you, and then one day you sit down and you realize, you know, he could have chosen that girl over there that he used to date. And he could have chosen this person, but he chose me. How does that make you feel? A smart man. Yeah, yeah. That makes you, you know, that makes you feel really good, and that makes that bond even stronger. Well, one of the arguments about free will versus foreordination, and one of the things that Lewis also says in a roundabout way is, if God truly is love, and if God is a God of love, and God desires love, and desires us to love, what is more meaningful in relationship, not only between us and God, but between each other, is that God gives us the ability to choose rather than making us automatons or robots where we don't have a choice. Where we don't have a choice. Not that God needs the gratification, but that God wants us to experience the same kind of relationship and love which God has for us. That's God's desire. But then that also means God takes a chance by giving us free will where we can choose to follow or not. So the shocking alternative to good and bad, we may not think it's such a shock, but really if you think about it, the shocking alternative is that God said, okay, you can choose. That's what Lewis is saying here. You can choose. Instead of saying you have to do it this way, you can choose. Now, there are those who argue infralapsarianism, big word that I mentioned last time. God created humans. God allowed humans to choose to fall or not. And then God chose some to be saved and not others. Supralapsarianism, which is another extreme, it's a hyper-Calvinist view, is that God predetermined even the fall. When God thought about creating, God determined ahead of time, I'm going to create people so they will fall, so that I can save some of them, and so that they'll know how magnanimous and loving I can be. But I'm not going to choose these others. I'm just going to choose some of them. Oh, he made it? He did use power and taught the Israelites, and that's really interesting, because about half the time it says Pharaoh hardened his heart, and the other half the time it says and the Lord hardened his heart to teach. And that would be a similar position. Then you've got Jacob Arminius, who said God in Christ decreed to elect from fallen humanity those who grace believed and persevered, and to reject unbelievers. But that doesn't mean God elected who would be saved and who would not. So God chose to elect from fallen humanity anybody who would believe and persevere. And if they are unbelievers, they are rejected. Why? Because they have rejected God. If God's not going to force you to be saved or not to be saved, God's certainly not going to force you to be saved if you don't want to be. That's what Arminius said. Christ died for everyone, not just the elect. No one could believe without God's grace, because you find God's grace and that gets you to believe. Doesn't force you to believe, but allows you to see that grace, and you have the ability to choose to believe. All good works are ascribed to grace, but grace is not irresistible. True believers might fall away from faith. It is possible. If you were given the ability to choose to follow, does that mean that once you choose to follow, you no longer have the ability to choose, and therefore there's no free choice? That's the heritage out of which General Baptists came. We have all kinds of, I'm going to finish in a minute, TJ. I know, I'm over. But I got started late. I appreciate it. I really do. But I got started late. Give me one more minute. On the other hand, you've got five-point Calvinism known as the tulip. Grows in the garden. Not all Calvinists hold to this, by the way. There are three-point Calvinists, there are five-point Calvinists. Like I said, they're hyper-Calvinists. And I can point you to some hyper-Calvinists. But the TULIP is an acronym. T. Total depravity of man. Excuse me. Total depravity of humanity. One time I said total depravity of man, and there were some women in the group. Well, see, we told you. But the T. We as human beings are totally depraved, and we don't deserve any kind of grace. U. Unconditional election. God unconditionally elects to save some, and they are elected not only unconditionally, but they can't get out of it. L. Limited atonement. Jesus only died for the elect, not for the world. Now, I know some folks who are, from a Calvinist perspective, that's a problem for them, the limited atonement. They're three-point Calvinists. They have a problem. Most of them have a problem with number three. I have asked some folks, well, then what do you do with John 3:16, for God so loved the cosmos, the world, that He gave His only Son, that whosoever believes? The answer I have gotten back from most folks, not all, but most folks, is, including colleagues of mine at Erskine and other places, well, that doesn't mean the whole world. That means the elect and the rest of the world. I. Irresistible grace. Never met her. Don't care to. Irresistible grace. The grace of God is irresistible for the elect, but it will never bring somebody who's not among the elect in. And if someone who's among the elect starts backsliding, the irresistible grace will draw them back. And then P on the tulip is either preservation of the saints or perseverance of the saints. Of course, we talk about perseverance. Arminius talked about perseverance. A lot of folks within strict Calvinism, a strict Calvinism, will talk about the preservation of the saints. Those whom God elects as the saints, God will preserve to the end.
I have a question.
Yes?
What is the need for Jesus to come down the cross if there's an elect?
If there was the elect, it was part of God's plan to show the elect that they were among the elect, to reach out to them, to give them that means. And there are some in some Calvinist circles who don't evangelize. There are others that do to a limited degree. And I've asked them, why do you evangelize if it's just the elect? And they said, how do we know that this is God's foreordained plan for that person to be, to realize they're among the elect? That's your answer. Now, that's strange to some of us. However, the president of Southern Baptist Seminary says we are and always have been and always will be five-point Calvinists. He knows better. But that's the direction of a large group within the Southern Baptist Convention. And that's what he teaches, and quite frankly, that's what most of the SBC seminaries teach now, is Calvinism, including predestination. So it really is a mix out there. And strict Calvinists, hyper-Calvinists would say, oh, the shocking alternative? The shocking alternative is that you think you got free will and you choose it. Whereas free will folks would say, well, the shocking alternative when we've got free will is that God predestines it. Volumes. I could fill my office and the library and probably Vicky's office just with books on Calvinism or Arminianism. Like I said, we can't solve it in now. I've run over 3 more minutes. All of this time. But think. That's what I want you to do, is think through chapter 3 here with a shocking alternative. We make a thing voluntary. Half people do it, half don't. God made it voluntary to choose, and some choose and some don't. And that's where evil comes in. And that's where this odd sense where the world takes over comes in. Well, please, eat, drink, have fun, except if you're choir members. TJ's going to crack the whip. But we will not be here next Sunday. The Singspiration is going on. I'm sorry we won't be here, but we will be in Georgetown, outside of D.C. But we will continue this later. But the Singspiration will be better than this anyway. So I hope you will be here next Sunday and support those folks, and I hope you all will support it. And as you go, know this, God loves us so much that even in spite of our own wranglings, God's desire is that we know God and that we share that grace with each other, even when sometimes it confuses us. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.